Hey, welcome to the show. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, back again, once again, sitting here and eager to talk. You got to be just as eager to hear, though. So let's get on with it. At the back end of the show, we're going to follow up on the coverage we did last week, that we began last week at the start of the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, the Pelican Bay SHU prisoners who are on a hunger strike. And they're on a hunger strike with five basic demands. Most of them amount to insisting that they be treated like human beings, even though they're in prison. All right? And it's extremely important that we keep up on that, keep up on what's going on. So Manuel LaFontaine from All of Us or None, as well as a representative of the Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition, that's Manuel, he's both of them, he's going to give us an update on the hunger strike and various solidarity actions that are going on. Before that, we'll be listening to an interview I did with Lance Tapley, an investigative journalist, an award-winning investigative journalist and contributor to The United States in Torture, edited by Marjorie Cohn. In that interview, he talks about he describes the prisons in the U.S. Supermax system and what goes on inside them and what's behind them and the horror of these prisons. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back after not having her on the show for quite some time. I'm really, really happy to have her back. We had a really interesting discussion the last time, and it was around the Super Bowl and their anti-abortion ad. And Amanda Marcotte is our first guest, and we're going to be talking with her about her recent article, Why We Need to Keep Countering Extremist Lies with Facts. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And I should tell people that you write regularly. You have your own blog, Pandagon, and you write regularly for RH Reality Check. RHRealityCheck.org is the site. And you recently had an article that really caught my eye, and I think because it's such an important subject in the world today, and that is why we need to keep countering extremist lies with facts. Can you tell people why you were moved to write this article?
Well, the main motivation was that I had been asked to speak at a conference in Minneapolis on the topic of fighting the religious right from a kind of skeptical pro-science point of view. And I got a really great reception from the audience, who I think was somewhat unaware, because they were there, you know, as pro-science people, not necessarily as feminist activists. I think they were unaware of how much scientific misinformation the religious right is promoting around reproductive rights out there. So it occurred to me that there's a big knowledge gap out in the world outside of reproductive rights activists about how bad the situation is, how many lies are being promoted by the religious right.
So I want to get into that in particular in relation to reproductive health and in relation specifically to abortion and abortion rights. But I also wanted to, you know, speak to something a little bit more general in the beginning, and that is that this really is, I mean, one of the things that struck me in reading your article, and it provoked some thought on my part in terms of this, what a huge problem this is in general in society today, and how it really took a leap. And again, it's in line with the leap in the Christian fundamentalists, the Christian fascists actually coming out and asserting their political strength and their organizational, you know, power and all this other stuff. There was a whole thing under Bush where it really became, as Karl Rove once argued, that, you know, he wasn't interested in reality-based thinkers. He kind of mocked reality-based thinkers. And he said, we create our own reality. And as funny as it is, it's also a very dangerous situation in the world today.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what the Republican Party in general has understood, and they've really kind of come into their own on, is that most people decide what they believe and then they fit the facts to fit that belief. Most people don't look at the facts and then make a conclusion. And so once they realized facts are kind of irrelevant, they went whole hog on just say whatever you want, you know. The old expression, you have a right to your own opinion, but you don't have a right to your own facts, well, they just don't agree with that anymore.
Yeah, okay. You don't have a right to your own facts. Okay. You know, one of the things, and I'm thinking about that because it's, look, I'll tell you, as a communist, I come up against this all the time, as you can well imagine. You know, you can walk into any bookstore and find 1,000 books today that'll tell you how bad communism was across the board, and one of the things that really got me was when I looked at the scholarship, the level of scholarship on something like that, that was just unacceptable. People would be laughed out or driven out of academia if they actually, you know, if there was any serious assertion of the need for rigorous scholarship. And you know, Ward Churchill, for instance, did get driven out of academia and his whole, you know, for a few minor mistakes and footnotes. But then I read books that were like, for instance, on China, where a guy actually cited, he said he was describing, you know, the terrible situation in China as he described it, as he saw it. And as proof for what he was asserting, he said, the source for this was a reliable, a source known to be reliable by the author. You know, it's like, wait a minute. And this is a cat at Harvard. This is McFarquhar, Roderick McFarquhar at Harvard, you know, a big political science and history, you know, expert. And he gets away with that. And I think it really comes out in these things that are cutting edge issues in the world today. And in particular around reproductive health, this is a major, major problem.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely say like the two biggest areas in my experience where you're seeing Republicans just promote misinformation blatantly is like global warming and reproductive health. And I think, you know, you could also make the argument for economics, but that's a little bit more hazy of a field. But when it comes to biology, like the biology of the human body, and the scientific research about it, that's known facts. And they say things repeatedly that aren't true, including and as I was listening in the article, you know, some of the myths on the right are that abortion causes depression. It does not. Abortion causes breast cancer. It does not. That the birth control pill doesn't work. It does. That condoms have holes in them that allow HIV to pass through. Not true. You know, you could basically go on and on. I got a big laugh at the conference by telling about how there's, in right-wing circles, there's this story that goes around about a baby supposedly being born with an IUD in its hand.
Oh, God.
You know, that couldn't have happened.
What? Oh, man. But see, it's funny, but it's so damn, you know, enraging and dangerous because, look, I mean, think about this. They, you know, they also have this thing that in line with the laws that they passed in many states that women now are being forced to look at these sonograms. And, you know, look at the little baby, the fetus, and that baby will feel pain. And look at that baby. Did that little baby smile? You know, and you're looking, you know, when you're looking at a fetus at that stage in development, what the hell are they talking about? And these kinds of lies that get built up on top of people's, you know, general understanding of, and lack of understanding in science, because frankly, we are not known for our scientific rigor in education right now. And, you know, you think about that, what's being done there and what's being reinforced. It's really horrifying.
Yeah, the ultrasound thing is really funny because I think that's an example of legislators have this one idea of what an ultrasound looks like. And you're right, it doesn't, when women are getting abortions, it doesn't look like that at all. Like, they're thinking of those ultrasounds that you're doing, you know, at 25, 30 weeks, where you can actually see, like, what looks like a baby on the screen, but most women get their abortions between 8 and 12 weeks. There's not much there. What's funny about it is a lot of abortion providers say that women are often reassured when they look at the ultrasound because they realize there's not much there. That said, you know, I oppose these ultrasound laws because you're right, there's more to them than just the fact that they have to do the ultrasound. They're also often told that they have to endure a lecture that's, you know, full of misinformation about how it's a baby and how it's developed at a certain to a certain period, which it hasn't. Like you said, there's claims that they can feel or are responsive when they're not. And I think, you know, that stuff, even though it's all untrue, could scare a woman getting an abortion very badly or freak her out. And for no reason whatsoever, there's nothing that she should be worried about.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Amanda Marcotte. Amanda is the writer and manager of the blog Pandagon, and she also writes regularly her commentaries and analysis on RH Reality Check. Now, Amanda, you know, one of the things that actually gets down to this, too, is that I was thinking about this when you're talking about what's the truth behind all this in relation to these, you know, ultrasounds and whatnot. The fact that for most of the time when women get an abortion, that actually the fetus is about the size of a period at the end of a sentence, you know, and it's, you know, when you think about this, that they're promoting a certain, you know, they're coming from the people who promote this kind of these lies and tell these lies about the situation around abortion and what's going on and what's happening. You know, they're coming from a certain ideological view, and they really are marshaling or creating so-called facts or non-facts in order to support that ideological view. It seems very, very, you know, apparent in something like abortion. And I know you've spoken to that, including in terms of this idea of why the hell do they lie so damn much?
Well, that's an interesting question because, as I noted in the article, you would not necessarily think you have to lie because your people are going to believe whatever they want to believe regardless of the fact, right? So I think that the reason that they lie is because they're aiming their arguments both at policy, trying to get them into policy, and also because they want to get the mushy middle to understand or to be confused on the issues. So, for instance, you know, if you, for instance, are against a program of distributing condoms to prevent HIV in a developing country, you're not going to get very far by admitting that condoms are really effective against HIV. You're not going to get far in the legislative arguments, nor are people in the mushy middle going to respect you at all. They're going to say, look, it works, and we may not like it, but you got to do what works. So what they do is they kind of lie about it, and then that way they can kind of justify their beliefs in spaces that they might not otherwise get very far.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this in relation to a problem, a very real problem that a lot of this has helped to both generate and strengthen, and that is the stigma around abortion in this country today, because that is an intensely important phenomenon that's going on, and it's a really, really dangerous phenomenon for women as well as for the clinics and the staff of the clinics themselves and the future of abortion, because it's not just defending the rights legally, but even the fact that so few abortion doctors are being trained, abortion providers are being trained in medical school today. This is very much, I think, not completely bound up with, but very much influenced by and tied into the stigma that these lies creates around abortion.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those where there's smoke, there's fire kind of situation. So if they lie and say that abortion causes depression, that abortion causes breast cancer, that abortion failure rates are higher than they are, their abortions don't really have failure rates per se, but there's a lot of myths flying around on the right that somehow some babies survive it. There's myths that abortions are dangerous when they're not. All of these things go to help establish the image of the abortion provider as somehow not a real doctor, but some kind of crank working out of a basement or something like that. When, in fact, on the right, you also hear them try to reinforce this message by refusing to call abortion providers doctors, even though that's what they are. Instead, they call them they call it the abortion industry or even abortion mills, you know, both of which are completely inaccurate language. And it does help establish this notion that somebody who provides abortion is somehow less than a real doctor. In real life, of course, abortion providers are gynecologists mostly. And, you know, some people drifted into providing abortions out of being general practitioners. Most of them are gynecologists. Just like any other gynecologist, there's nothing wrong with them. But, you know, it helps create this shame and the stigma. It also makes it harder for abortion providers to get respect and support from the rest of the medical community, which is weird because most of the medical community is quietly pro-choice. But they don't want to associate with abortion providers because it's so stigmatized.
Which actually ends up also creating, I mean, in a really terrible way. It ends up creating the ground. I mean, think about this. Abortion providers are the only doctors that go to work every day with the understanding that they could or wake up or go to sleep every day with the understanding that they could be killed at any moment and have been killed by these, you know, Christian fundamentalist fascists that come out there. I mean, Dr. Tiller being the most recent example, but we have a whole line of the amount of arson attacks on clinics and their various other attacks, the attacks on doctors themselves. This is not an easy, you know, this is a profession where I think a lot of the medical doctors that go into this are actually very dedicated and very dedicated to the understanding and the belief and the very important understanding that women are in fact full human beings and deserve to be treated as such. This is something that I think ideologically on that level and morally, these are people really committed to the well-being of their patients in a way that very few other branches of medical service are actually committed.
Absolutely. And when you actually speak to abortion providers, a lot of the time they have some story or some experience that drove home to them how necessary this service is. And so, yes, they've given over a lot of their life and no small part of their sanity in some cases mm-hmm. To helping women. And nobody thanks them for it. It's all very sad.
Well, you know, one thing, it's interesting because I remember Dr. Tiller's comment about his idea of just of trust women. And among the abortion providers that I've interviewed over the years, and there's been a number of them, you know, the big thing has been the fulfillment that they have is actually fulfilling that knowing the tremendous service that they're getting. And actually, I noticed there's a young woman who started a website, I Am Dr. Tiller, after Dr. Tiller was killed. And the response from people that actually, you know, was really moving, from women who stood up and told their stories about abortions. And there's also a movement in terms of countering the stigma. The idea that, you know, there are women, and I think this was on RH Reality Check, there was a woman who said, I was very happy to get an abortion, which is something you rarely see. Given the stigma, what do you think about that? I mean, this is something that's very rare, it seems to me, for women to say, you know what, I got an abortion, and damn it, it changed my life all for the good.
It is very rare, and the irony there is that that's actually how most women feel if pressed about it. Not all. I mean, people are diverse, and a lot of women, you know, get abortions more in sorrow than anything else. And it's no fun at the time. But, you know, generally speaking, and most of the scientific research on this demonstrates it, women's main feeling after getting an abortion is a feeling of relief. Relief that it's over, relief that they don't have to worry about it anymore, relief that all these things, horrible things they thought were going to happen to them because they had an unwanted pregnancy have now just gone away. I mean, how many times in our life do we actually just have such a major problem with such a simple solution, honestly? Mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound callous, but that's just how it is. And, you know, again, we're not talking about the taking of a human life in any meaningful sense. It's a potential human life, but not a real one. And so women's feelings are going to reflect that, but there's this huge stigma for it. So, in fact, even pro-choicers tend to go in public and pull faces and say, it's an extremely hard decision and nobody feels good about it. Well, that's not entirely true. You know, in reality, you know, women may think about it for a while, but when they decide that they want an abortion, they're fairly hard to pull from that decision. They're very certain of what they want. They don't want to have a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they insist on having the right to not be enslaved, and that is, having the right to exercise control over their own body and what happens to it. So to me, it's extremely important on that level, too. A quick reminder, we're talking with Amanda Marcot, who is a writer and manager of the blog Pandagon. And Amanda's also a frequent contributor, commentator, and analyst on the site rhrealitycheck.org. That's reproductive health, rhrealitycheck.org, a really great website. So don't forget to check it out. You know, one thing I was going to ask you, and we're going to move to wrap up, but I wanted to, you know, I know you made a point in your article about, look, we're not out to win. We're not looking to win over these various Christian fundamentalists and the fascists that are out there and all these right-wing people and stuff. But there is and I know you refer to people as in the mushy middle, and I understand what you're talking about there. And although I would actually say that those people are very important to actually, you know, in terms of public opinion, in terms of trying to carry out this struggle, this battle for public opinion is very important. But we also need people, I think, in a bigger sense, men and women, to stand up and defend abortion rights for women, to defend the abortion providers, and to recognize the assault that they're undergoing now. And I was thinking in particular in relation to Dr. Leroy Carhart, who, you know, has been under attack ever, you know, before Dr. Tiller was killed, and since Dr. Tiller was killed, he's been, you know, faced up with all kinds of attacks in Nebraska. He's now opening a new clinic in Germantown, Maryland, and he's been, you know, immediately the Christian fundamentalists have rushed to attack that. And he's been part of a group calling for a summer of choice, a summer of trust around his clinic in Germantown, Maryland. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Can you tell people a little bit about what you know about it? And the importance of doing that, of standing with these abortion providers.
Well, one of the things that we know about hate groups, and I consider the anti-choice movement, particularly at least the very rabid ones who show up at clinics, be functionally a hate group of sorts, is that they feel empowered by the sense that they're speaking for the community. And so when you show up and you very loudly and pointedly demonstrate that they are not speaking for you, that you disagree with them, that the community actually supports abortion rights and supports abortion providers, they feel less sure of themselves. It's actually incredibly damaging to hate groups to see that people in the community aren't secretly agreeing with them, but in fact are loudly disagreeing with them. So I think, you know, we can sometimes feel a little bit down about all this and think there's nothing that we can do, but one of the most important things we can do is not be shy about our support for abortion rights, because the more adamant we are, the more people are going to see we're not kidding around and that we're not ambivalent about this at all. And in fact, in the 60s, when the abortion rights movement really kind of took off, you know, feminists were incredibly bold, saying abortion on demand now, and were often demanding that it be free. And in response to this, the American public swung far to the left on abortion rights. There was actually more strong support for abortion rights back then than there is now, which is kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, people saw the need for it.
And we need to actually, in terms of that whole thrust, we do need to reinvigorate that slogan, that understanding of abortion on demand without apology and free, as you once said on the last time you were on the show. I think it's extremely important. Amanda, you know, part of the thing I really recommend that people read your article, and they can find it in RH Reality Check, rhrealitycheck.org. And because the whole point of countering extremist lies with facts has everything to do with how this struggle to defend abortion rights, to defend women demanding abortions, and to defend abortion providers is rooted in understanding the truth about what's actually going on. So I want to thank you very much for contributing to that.
Thank you.
Okay. And thanks for joining us, and we'll have you back again soon. So take care.
Bye.
Bye now. All right. We've been talking with Amanda Marcotte, who's has the blog Pandagon, and she also writes for rhrealitycheck.org. And you can check her work out there. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, you'll be listening to an interview I did with Lance Tapley, investigative journalist and contributor to the United States in Torture. And he'll be talking about the Supermax prisons and how they developed. But a short break first, and we'll be right back with that.
Some birds don't deserve to be caged. They gotta fly away and search for the way. Being locked up is worse than the grave. I live by the words on the page. I know some birds don't deserve to be caged. They gotta fly away and search for the way. Being held down is worse than the grave. I live by the words on the page. I say.
I jumped on the planet and I landed on both feet. Tippy toed across the continent on a dope beat.
Welcome back. That's AC Alone with Caged Bird from his album Magnificent City. All right. As I said earlier, we're going to be listening to Lance Tapley. I did this interview a while back, and he's an award-winning journalist and contributor to the United States in Torture. And we're talking about the Supermax prison system. He did a lot of work around that, a lot of study of that, a lot of exposure around what's going on with that. And this is particularly significant given the current hunger strike being waged by the prisoners in the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit up in Pelican Bay State Prison. So let's take a listen to this interview now. Joining us now is one of the contributors to the United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, and that's Lance Tapley. Lance is a freelance investigative journalist, and he's a political writer for the Portland Phoenix in Maine. And his series on torture in Maine's Supermax Prison won a National First Place Award from the Association of Alternative Weeklies. Lance, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start off with this. Your piece, Notes from a Supermax Prison, your piece in the anthology, The United States in Torture, opens up with a statement that the American prison system has become a monster. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are an exceptional nation, as you know, and we are the world torture champions in what happens in our prison system. That's qualitatively. Quantitatively, we have, of course, the biggest prison system in the world. We have 4.5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. We have in our five times the world average incarceration rate, 2.3 million people behind bars, two-thirds of them are black or Hispanic. I could go on. Our incarceration rate is four times what it was in 1980.
Well, one of the things you say in relation to all this is that beyond the blossoming, the mushrooming of imprisonment in U.S. society, there's something else that's been formed up. It's a network of supermax prisons that are not only extraordinarily cruel, but in fact constitute a network of mass torture unique in the world and in history. Can you explain that?
Well, that is a pretty big claim, I realize. Supermax prisons are, well, supermax stands for super maximum security. And they feature solitary confinement, and they feature total control, and lots of harshness. There's a basic sort of idea here that one must be exceptionally harsh with the people in these prisons. And there are, estimates vary, but there are at least 36,000 and upwards of 75 to 100,000, depending on how you want to count it, on how you want to define it, people in these prisons in the federal, especially the state systems, the county, city, jails, etc. But they're all on the same template, which is super maximum security or supermax. And there is no other country that does this. I mean, there's an occasional supermax here and there, but for example, in England and Wales, there are 75,000 prisoners. There are about 40 people who might be considered to be in this category of imprisonment there.
Even in places that the U.S. is always very fond of pointing to for their prisons and dungeons, including even Nazi Germany, this kind of isolation and treatment was rare.
Well, for one thing, it's expensive. It's two or three times the expense of general population imprisonment. And, you know, people in other countries just apparently weren't willing to do that. I'm sure that if the Nazis had thought of it and they felt they had the money, they would have done it. But we've done it. And it's, you know, it's a mass torture that I haven't been able to find any historical parallel to, and certainly there's no parallel in other countries. I mean, we in this country spend a lot of time talking about the human rights violations in other countries, and of course there are a number of people rightfully upset with what has happened at Guantanamo and before that at Abu Ghraib, but we really don't have yet a consciousness that is widespread in this country about the really big crime in terms of this torture sweepstakes, if you will, which is the supermax prisons in the U.S.
All right, that's the good old spirit of American capitalism. We not only thought about it, but God damn it, we did it. You know, and you think about it. Now think about what that's saying about the nature of this society and what it's unleashed upon the world in terms of it being unparalleled and unprecedented. You know, and one of the things that you talk about is that this parallels a lot what the U.S. is doing internationally. Can we talk about that?
Well, you know, Bradley Manning recently, his imprisonment in solitary confinement has brought this issue more to the fore. And I've noticed that on news sites and blog sites, people are starting to talk about what's happening in this country. He is in a military prison. But, you know, we've had this concern about what's among many people in the special prisons, for example, at Guantanamo and at rendition sites and so forth, that the military and the CIA have had. But we just haven't had much of a consciousness. But I think this consciousness is growing, and people are starting to say, why are we doing this? And that's a very big question.
You brought up Bradley Manning, and in your piece you bring up two forms of torture. One is cell extractions, which I think you can talk to a little bit and let people know what they are, and the other is forced isolation, the solitary confinement, and you describe this as the worst form of torture inflicted on supermax prisoners. Can you speak to those two things?
Well, cell extractions are when you do something that the guards don't like. For example, if you maybe paste something over the tiny window in your steel door to your cell, and they can't see what you're doing, or you refuse to put your hands through the food slot, you're fed through the slot that you don't really have any contact normally with other human beings. Or you might even just curse out a guard, and then they send in a team, a kind of SWAT team, and they knock you down, and they put ankle shackles on and handcuffs on, and they drag you out off, and they'll cut your clothes off, and they'll take you down the cell block to the restraint chair room and put you in the restraint chair to cool you off. This often damages prisoners greatly. I mean, this is very bad physically, but you know, a lot of people have the ability to recover from physical harm, but it's very difficult to recover from the psychological harm that solitary confinement inflicts. And there's been a massive body of medical literature on solitary confinement for 150 years, actually, because it was tried in the 19th century and it was abandoned. And it just makes people psychotic. About three quarters of the prisoners get mentally damaged. A lot of them, you know, have paranoia, hallucinations, even catatonia. It becomes a very bad problem for many prisoners. And this is something that, as I say, you know, you can be pretty sure if you have any prolonged solitary confinement, it's going to hit a very large percentage of prisoners. It's a sure thing.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking now with Lance Tapley, who's an investigative journalist, and he's one of the contributors to this really good new anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, edited by Marjorie Cohn. And Lance's article in this anthology is Mass Torture in America, Notes from the Supermax Prisons. Now, you also mentioned in your piece that some of the people you interviewed for that article, sometimes they were extracted from their cells five times a day.
Well, that is kind of a record. I put that in because this one fellow that I interviewed had that happen to him. He sort of was the record holder in the main state prison. But these are common. I mean, these go on a daily basis in supermaxes all over the country. And the idea is total control. I mean, that's what the solitary confinement is about. But when these people who may not be nonviolent and may not have really done anything to in any rational way deserve it are taken out of their cell, they have to have a guard on either side. I mean, this is, for example, if they're just going to have a shower, a guard on either side, they have to have shackles on their ankles, and they have to have handcuffs, and they're sort of goose-stepped down the corridor to the shower room. I mean, these are people who may be in prison for something like fraud or burglary, and who may have no history of violence. And you know, the biggest common denominator in supermax prisons is mental illness. People who can't follow the rules of the prison. It's a prison within a prison, so they're put in the supermax. In the main state prison, for example, there are several people there who got themselves tattooed. And, you know, for one reason or another, they were caught in the act, and they're thrown into solitary confinement. That it has become the way to deal with anything you don't like if you're a guard or if you're a prison official.
I interviewed somebody a couple weeks ago who had done an investigation of the supermax prisons in California and solitary confinement and how they work. And, you know, a lot of what we're told is that many of the prisoners, the most of the prisoners that are sent to the supermax prisons are considered to be the worst of the worst. But in reality, there's a tremendous percentage of mentally ill people in these prisons. And there's people who are just rebellious. And even though the percentage of political prisoners compared to the 1960s and 70s is not as high as it was then, when you look at the people being held in solitary confinement in these supermax prisons, quite a high percentage of them, given the low percentage of them in relation to the overall prison population, quite a high percentage of the prisoners in the supermax prisoners and enforced isolation are made up of these rebellious prisoners.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, political prisoners. A lot of the people in supermax are there because they have been dissident in one way or another within the prison. I mean, they may have protested conditions in some fashion. They may have stood up for another prisoner. They may have in some way alienated the officials. So this is where they go. In that sense, they are political prisoners. The prisoner who turned me on to what was happening in the supermaxes was, as his reward, sent out of state to try to get him out of my clutches and out of the clutches of the rest of the news media and put into a supermax in Baltimore. And, you know, there was no reason. The guy never had any history whatsoever of violence or escape or anything else. It was just simply that's the way they deal with them.
One of the things that was also brought out here, and you talk about this, the idea that, again, so many of the prisoners in supermax and in isolation are actually mentally ill to begin with. Now, this was a big scandal in California regarding the management, the special management units. When they go for therapy, the ones that are allowed to go for therapy find themselves sitting in a little boxed cage, chained up, and their therapist is sitting across the room, supposedly out of spitting distance and whatnot, and talking to them through this box. And if they have group therapy, the therapist is surrounded by a circle of boxes and is talking to prisoners chained up in individual boxes. This is the kind of treatment that people get in these prisons, a sort of forced isolation even within forced isolation. It's just bizarre and barbaric.
Well, think about it. How can you give therapy to people who are 99% of the time in a situation, solitary confinement, that's driving them crazy?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I mean, so therapy becomes a fraudulent gesture. It becomes a bureaucratic fraud. In Maine, what they do is they have a mental health worker go a couple times a week to the door, the cell door, of which is a solid steel cell door of the supermax prisoner, and the mental health worker yells through the food slot, and of course there's no privacy, which is kind of an important aspect of any psychological therapy, to the prisoner for a few minutes, and he may or may not yell something back. So it's just absurd.
Now you think about that, and they're in a situation that is driving them insane. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Lance Tapley, a freelance investigative journalist who's based in Maine, and a guy who's a contributor to the fairly new anthology and really good anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, which is edited by Marjorie Cohn. Now, this anthology is all about torture outside the borders of the U.S. and inside the borders of the U.S., and this is what Lance's piece focuses on, the torture concentrated in the chain of supermax prisons across the U.S. Now, let me ask you one more question, Lance. You cite George Orwell in his book, 1984, saying that the object of torture is torture. You know, I thought that was really important because it brings us right back to the morality issue. There's never a justification for it, and indeed, people can say that the purpose of torture has more to do with establishing fear and establishing total control. That's true, but I think that there's actually something much more basic to it in terms of morality.
Well, yeah, and I think we all have to look at this. I think we're all complicit in this. I mean, I didn't know a thing about what was going on until 5 years ago when this prisoner through an intermediary got in touch with me. And you know, we have to ask, why is it that some people are upset about Guantanamo, but they're not upset about what's going on in the supermaxes? And then you have that immediately takes you to the question of why are we engaged in the larger prison madness, putting so many people in prison for such long terms for, in many cases, nonviolent crimes. We're the only country that does this, as I cited. The statistics are absolutely amazing. And the people who've looked at this, the scholars and activists who spent the most time on this question, including a lot of prisoners, of course, they see racism and they see classism. I've come to that conclusion. In Maine, we don't have many minorities. For example, in most of the people in the prison, therefore, are white people, but they're all very poor, or nearly so, nearly all of them. And you know, we've got to look at how we're dealing with the people at the bottom in terms of the economic structure if carefully. And if we do, I think we'll see that we're dealing with a lot of them by putting them in prison. And then, you know, the prison within the prison for those people who, one way or another, can't deal with the rules of the prison, and as I mentioned, they may be mentally ill too. Those people are the people who get this incredible harshness. And you know, it's such a complex issue. I mean, we've had this harshness in a historical context for the past 30 years, and you have to look at the political atmosphere. You have to look at also what we did in terms of basically tearing down the mental health structure, but not putting a good community mental health system in its place, and so the prisons have become the de facto asylums. You have to look at the media, sensationalism about crime, which a lot of opportunistic politicians have taken advantage of. You have to look at the war on drugs. About 20% of the people in prison are there because of that, on and on. And then, of course, when you develop this sizable prison industrial complex, if you will, and it's not just private prisons, that's a small part of it, really. It has to do with the public system. Then you've got a lot of investment right there. So we have to ask ourselves a lot of questions. It's a complex issue, but at the same time, you can come to, I think, to some simple conclusions about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think actually one of them is, which is not so simple, but is definitely true. When you think about this, I mean, I think the point you were raising about who's being mainly bearing the brunt of all this and who's it being targeted against. When you put together what you were saying even about when the supermaxes began with the tie-in with the mushrooming of the prison population, and you think about that, you know, the Reagan era and the war on drugs when that began, Michelle Alexander's book really just stunningly documents how that this mushrooming of the prison population to such a gigantic number and mainly focused on Black people and then Latino people, but mainly when you look at it, the numbers of Black people forced into jail these days as routine. So you have whole sections of youth who think, look, you know, it's just you grow up expecting you're going to do some time in jail. And then what happens in terms of this social control, this dehumanization, and what Michelle argues is the formation, it's part and parcel of the formation of a new Jim Crow within this country.
Right. But what I'm saying is it's basically, you know, an oppression of a class of people. I mean, many of those people, of course, are blacks and Latinos. But it's an oppression of the poor, I think, basically. And, you know, you talked about the harshness of the conservative element in our political world have got the American people to accept. But one thing that you should understand, and that your listeners should understand, is that this was all accepted by the liberals. The liberals have really only recently have they started to become concerned about the prisons, in at least in any numbers of them. I mean, the liberal politicians throughout the past 30 years have basically not uttered a peep.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Lance Tapley, who is one of the contributors to a new anthology, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, edited by Marjorie Cohn. I don't disagree with you, and I think it's extremely important for people to understand. And there needs to be some outrage, damn it. There really needs to be some outrage around this. And I just don't think people can sit back and allow this to go on unspoken to.
I think there actually is starting to be a larger consciousness of this. And you know, obviously Bradley Manning, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, that's increasing the consciousness of what is torture and what the United States does. And there is more activism in terms of groups like the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, which was only focused on U.S. torture outside the country, and now adopting Supermax as a cause, a campaign against torture within this country is what they have adopted. And so has the American Civil Liberties Union as well, and other groups. So there is a greater consciousness of this. In Maine, we've had a bill in the legislature, which didn't succeed this first time around, but it's going to come around again, to limit solitary confinement to 45 days and not allow seriously mentally ill people to be in solitary confinement. Within the Supermax prison in Maine, for example, the figure is 50% of the people there are officially classified as seriously mentally ill. So that would do a large, that if that bill passed, it would do make a large gesture toward emptying the Supermax. In Illinois, there's also a big campaign against Supermax imprisonment. And there have been some success stories brought about through litigation. For example, the ACLU took on the state of Mississippi, and they got Mississippi in a settlement of a lawsuit to reduce its Supermax population considerably. New York, there have been some successes too. So this consciousness is increasing. There's more political activism. And, you know, despite the dark vision of this situation that I perhaps portrayed in our interview, I think that there is some cause for optimism.
Okay, Lance, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure,
very much,
thank you. All right, welcome back. This is Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we were talking with, that was an interview I did a little while back with Lance Tapley, award-winning investigative journalist. He did a whole series on the Supermax prisons. And he also was a contributor to The United States in Torture, which is a book and anthology edited by Marjorie Cohn. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by Manuel LaFontaine, who will be talking with us about the developments in the Pelican Bay hunger strike. All right, so check this out. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
You lost your right to live when they sentenced you to prison. Feeling cold and empty, gutted like from an incision. Some fall back on religion, last refuge of a free faller. And you can't call her. So holler if you hear me through the cell walls, like being trapped in hell. I'm trying to tell y'all, when you lock men in cages, they can turn to animals, contagious. Dog eat dog, rabid cannibals. Start off from the bullpen where you'll spend many hours sleeping on the concrete floor and getting any shower. Stomach growling from the phony, two-tone baloney that they feed you. Leave you lonely in a room full of thousands. Pounding on the block with your head, wishing you dead instead of buried alive inside of a 9x10. Wishing you were kissing your children or with your girl instead of dreaming of what life's like back in the world. Inside these cement caves lives modern day slaves, working for corporations that pay $1 a day. It takes cash to make it, so it goes to where the money's all. Build more prisons, I give them another 20 bars.
All right, welcome back. And that was Incarceration from Sunrise Above, and the name of the album is Waking Up on the Wrong Side of Capitalism. Joining us now is Manuel LaFontaine from All of Us or None, as well as the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition, and he's going to talk with us about recent developments since the prisoner hunger strike up in Pelican Bay and a security housing unit began. Manuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, what are some of the key developments in the strike?
Well, there actually hasn't been many, and I say that to say that, well, there has been, but when no fundamental changes has happened in regards to CDC either negotiating or trying to either meet with the prisoners or meet with people that want to represent or amplify the voice of prisoners, it's a clear indication where they stand, and where they stand is that, you know, they're willing to let people die or jeopardize their health and safety, then, you know, start communication to figure out how do we resolve this.
So they're not, they basically have taken a stand that they're not going to end up in any kind of, you know, conferencing or anything like that with the prisoners or with the representatives of the prisoners' solidarity groups, right?
Right. And I think what they're doing is it's tactical on their part. So, you know, this is a system, a very torturous system. Like I've been telling different people, you don't have to go to Abu Ghraib. You right now in your contemporary Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay here in California. So what's going on is they're going to try to wait things out. So let's see how far we can take these prisoners, you know? And it's torturous in many ways because I was just recently, about 10 minutes ago, I was looking at this website and someone sent me a link in, and we have corrections-only websites or blogs where they basically say we should put a microwave and with a steak on it and underneath the cell doors, next to the cells where these people are going on strike and torture them even more. So, you know, this mindset that officials have and mindset that guards have and that fraternity within the law enforcement, this further feeds into that mentality that these are prisoners, these are the worst of the worst, when in reality the worst of the worst is Pelican Bay State Prison at the moment. The worst of the worst is not allowing people to be treated as human beings, to have their human rights restored. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're inside us should not constitute torture. Society should not condone torture.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the worst of the worst is actually a system that bases its entire treatment of masses of people on robbing them of their humanity of actually. And I think, you know, the point that Michelle Alexander has made and what a lot of people have made is basically the point of this is something that's a conscious policy very much linked to the war on drugs, all of that. You know, one of the things I did notice that the numbers of prison strikers, of hunger strikers last week, right when it began, right over the weekend, did actually mushroom to a very high number of people across the California state prison system. What was that number? It was like 6,000 or something?
Yeah, and it's probably, if CDC is admitting that, right, it begs the question, what else ain't they admitting, right? And it's 6,600 according to them, right? And here's the truth that CDC will never admit to anybody, right? At least not to the public, is that the hunger strike has gone across racial and geographical lines in the California State Prison, which is to be highly respected for those of us who are former prisoners, for those of us who are fighting for change and peace in our own communities, because this is extremely hard to do, especially after decades and generations of prison-manufactured racism, segregation, and violence. So what's going on is feared right now by the state. They don't want to see truth between gangs, so-called gangs, and gangs that they help propagate and the violence that came with it. They don't want to see that because when there's truth, there's peace, there's resistance, the focus goes back on the man. The focus goes back on the oppressive nature of the man, and the man being the administration of CDC. And here's another truth CDC won't tell you, that it segregates people who think critically and organizes and people that organizes others to think critically under the pretense of a threat to the security institution or staff or inmates or that you're a gang member. I mean, the minute one becomes politically engaged inside, meaning you begin to challenge the conditions of confinement or and begin to organize others to look beyond themselves and the social conditions that led to the incarceration, such as social, political, and economic oppression here in America and throughout the world, is the minute you're deemed the candidate for the shoe. That's something the CDC won't tell you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because what they do say and what I've read in a number of articles on the strike in various major national publications, they quote the CDC representatives saying that, what we can say is that gang members are leading this strike. And that shows why, in fact, we're correct to put them in isolation, that this is all about gang members and their influence across the prison population and not speaking at all to the demands, the very moving and very, you know, specific demands in terms of the demanding to be treated like a human being that the prisoners have put forward.
Yeah, well, the California Department of Corrections, I was once one of those people inside. CDC will do anything. I mean, everything within its power to protect their image. In fact, their image, their public relations, their spokespeople only exist to protect the reality behind it. And the reality is sheer torture. There is no conditions of confinement, it's conditions of torture. When you put somebody in a cell for 23 hours a day in a concrete chamber, that's torture. Imagine that the only human contact in the last 10, 15, 20 years is that of guards putting shackles on you. Or a vague recollection of someone who told you was a nurse, or she or he told you was a nurse from the medical field. Imagine if you have, if you are having a heart attack or need medical help and you need to call out for help and nobody can hear you because the walls and floors are soundproof. I mean, these pills are not asking to be released. They're asking for their basic human rights. They are demanding an end to torture. And that's what I'm here. I'm here. I'm not here to speak for them. I'm here to amplify that voice. And I'm all right now. I forgot how many hours and days, but I haven't eaten anything. And those that know me here in the Bay Area, I haven't eaten anything since June 30th. I haven't physically chewed on anything since June 30th. Because for me, this is more of standing in solidarity. A lot of people will talk the talk but won't walk the walk. I'm going to speak as someone that is the shoe, because I know that the minute, if I was to be caged up under some fraudulent or framed-up charges, trumped-up charges, they'd place me on in the shoe under the pretense of being involved in gangs. So I'm doing this for future people, for my young brothers and sisters in Los Angeles, in San Diego, throughout, who are caught up in the street madness and that street violence, who are right now candidates for the shoe, whether they recognize it or not.
Mm-hmm. Very important sentiment and statement, man. We're talking with Manuel LaFontaine, who is a representative of the Prisoners Hunger Strike Solidarity Committee, and we're talking about the ongoing hunger strike by prisoners in the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, the Pelican Bay SHU. Now, Manuel, let's talk about this because we're running up on our time, but I wanted to actually get a couple more questions in here. One is the response of the people outside the prison, the support that's been building for that. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, this is a lot of support, and it's a lot coming from, you know, the family members. So we can talk about the organized activists and the organizations that are many, right, throughout not only the Bay Area but California, in Canada, in Philadelphia, and so many places that have shown their support, right? We got prisoners on strike in other prisons who are just showing solidarity. But the family members is important to talk to, because I get to hear, I'm one of those people that gets the emails, that gets texts, that gets so sad calls saying, I just found out about the strike. I want to do something. I've been quiet because I don't want it to happen to my loved one. I want to do something. And what I've been trying to tell people is we have to do something. We have to start talking to other people, talk to our church members, talk to our community members. I just got a text last night from someone letting me know that three people are in the hospital, for example. And this is what it says. I got a text letting me know three people are in the hospital. So far, CDC is being quiet about releasing the details to the public. So sad I couldn't sleep afterwards, and I don't know how anyone could after learning this. So people are very concerned, and yet with this concern is also a victory. And this victory is the fact that the spirit, they can torture a human body, but they can't really torture the spirit and the enlightenment that's going on with people who are not in the shoe. So the victory here is that people are becoming aware. The victory is that the people now are starting to rise up and saying, I didn't know California could do that. I didn't know. And then when you start to question that notion of the worst, that's when you start to challenge them and say, there's a human being still. And if we're a country that, or a society that bases ourselves on democracy, on justice and liberty, and yet we're out here torturing people, so people are picking up, and there's going to be a solidarity event in Bay Area for those of us out here, and it's going to be an international day of solidarity. So many people throughout the country, throughout the world will be joining us as we basically are going to be demanding that CDC begin to negotiate, talk to the thousands of prisoners on strike, and as the numbers are continuing to grow.
All right, Manuel, where can people go to find out that information to keep up on updates on the prison strike and the hunger strike, and also updates on what actually, well, information about what's going on with the strike? Where can they go?
That's right. They can go to www.prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. Once again, prisoner, singular, hunger strike, solidarity.wordpress.com.
All right, Manuel, and let me tell people that people can write to this email address, youngclyde8, that's the numeral 8, at gmail.com. And you can also call the phone number 213-321-0414. Again, that's 213-321-0414, and the email is youngclyde, the numeral 8, at gmail.com. Manuel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and we'll talk to you again soon, man. Take care. All right, I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian around that's on this subject, and it's from his book, Basics. No more generations of our youth here and all around the world whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion even before they are born. I say no more of that. And that is certainly something that we should all join him in saying. We were talking with Manuel LaFontaine, who's a member of the Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity Committee, and also a member of All of Us or None. We were talking about the latest developments in the Pelican Bay hunger strike. And I want to thank my engineer today. It's Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my intern, Natalie Martinez. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And remember, keep on coming back. You know where to find us. We're right here on the corner of epistemology and morality. It's the place where if you know something is right, you got to do it. If you know something's wrong, you got to stand up and act against it. We're going to go out now. And actually, I'll tell you what, if you want to write to me for anything at all, write to it at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that I really recommend people go to YouTube, look it up. It's They Don't Really Care About Us. It's Michael Jackson. Look up the prison version of this thing. It'll knock your socks off, all right? So here's Michael Jackson with They Don't Really Care About Us.